debt. It keeps you tossing and turning at night. You can't get away from it. But the truth is, the system is designed to trap you in debt. Insanely high interest credit cards and loans make it nearly impossible to pay off your debt. There's a new way out of the debt trap, Pivotal Debt Solutions. Pivotal Debt Solutions isn't like the old school debt relief companies that string your debt out for years. They have aggressive strategies that can end your debt faster and easier than you thought possible. Pivotal Debt Solutions can cut or even eliminate interest. Find programs to write off your balances so you owe less. Stop those threatening phone calls, and without bankruptcy and without a loan. Bottom line, they find every solution possible to end your debt permanently. Before you do anything, contact Pivotal Debt Solutions first. Talk to them for free. Find out how fast they can help you get out of debt. Visit zapmydebt.com. That's zapmydebt.com. Zapmydebt.com.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. I want to introduce my colleague, honored friend, the host of the Joe Madison Show, weekdays 6 to 10 a.m. right here on Sirius XM, but he's on channel 126. We're on 127 here, I believe. The civil and human rights, lifelong civil and human rights activist, Joe Madison. His website, joemadison.com. You can tweet him at MadisonSiriusXM. And Joe, welcome back to the program. It's so nice to have you on, particularly on this auspicious day.
Well, I really appreciate it. And I also let people know that I just celebrated 43 years with Sherry. That's our wedding anniversary.
Oh,
and
wow.
She reminded me last Friday in the court. She said this is the first time because of this pandemic that we've actually been together, because usually I'm traveling and somewhere in honor of Dr. King or to continue his work. So something good came out of the pandemic, because unlike you, we broadcast with our spouses. To tell the truth, Tom, you know, we need to tell the truth. They run the show. So
yeah.
I know Louise runs it and Sherry runs it.
You're absolutely right, Joe.
So, and, hey, I just tell them, she's management, I'm labor. So,
yep. You know, same here.
But thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's my pleasure. So I think that your life and your experiences, sort of like those movies where they tell the story of an era through one person's perspective. I mean, you've been so deep in this so much of your life. I'd like to go through some of that, if that's all right with you. I mean, for example, as a young man, when did you first become aware of the civil rights movement, of the impact of racism in America? What was it like growing up when you were a child in America? And how did that help shape your work in the civil rights movement over the years?
Well, let's be honest. Look, I was impacted at the age of 5 years old when I saw a Jet magazine photograph of Emmett Till's body at his funeral. And I'm looking at this horror and going, what is that? And then even in that early stage, we used to go down to Clarksdale, Mississippi, where my grandfather was from, and I would spend summers with my cousins there. And that stopped in large part because of Emmett Till. And then let's just keep moving forward. Where do you want me to go? The riots in the 60s and...
Yeah, well, let's start there. I mean, we've got an hour. We've got plenty of elbow room here. I mean, in the 60s, I was very involved in the anti-war movement. I believe, as a teenager, I believe you were very involved in the civil rights movement, were you not?
Well, no. We were involved in both because, you know...
Yeah.
There's a difference. What you missed and what I said was a nugget of inferiority was planted in my mind at the age of 5. And that's what I think white America needs to understand. When you have to, Dr. King talks about this, having to explain to his young children why they can't swim in the public swimming pool. And then that seed of negativity is planted in that child's mind. As a child growing up in my neighborhood in Dayton, Ohio, and again, a child, Saturday morning, I remember this like it was yesterday, we would all gather, maybe we're 7, 8 years old, we would all gather at somebody's house and on a Saturday, early Saturday morning, and watch cartoons. And we'd be all watching one TV, but there'd be 4, 5, 6 kids. And I never will forget, next door neighbor, a white family, they were just the nicest people, but some uncle walked into the house and said, "Who are these little niggas on the rug?"
Whoa.
You're 7 or 8 years old. So I'm not prepared today to jump from Emmett Till to my age in college, but since you did, you have to remember it was Muhammad Ali who brought to my attention and to a lot of our attention that the Vietnam War was a situation where young African Americans, sometimes if they got in trouble, the judge would give them a choice. Son, you can go to the army, which means you'll end up in Vietnam, or you can go to jail. We often forget that young black inner city youth were drafted or are sent to Vietnam disproportionately. So we ended up fighting on both fronts at the same time, which, by the way, if you recall, may have been one of the reasons that Dr. King was killed a year after his famous speech in 1967 about why he opposed the Vietnam War. Because the resources that were used to fight the Vietnam War were taken primarily from many of the social programs that Johnson had invested in.
Yeah, remarkable stuff. We're talking with Joe Madison, host of The Joe Madison Show, weekdays 6 to 10 a.m. on Sirius XM channel 126. JoeMadison.com is his website. We'll be right back with our conversation with Joe Madison in just a moment.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And you can tweet Joe at Madison Sirius XM. Once again, his show is on Sirius XM channel 126, 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Time, Monday through Friday. You can help America return to democracy by telling friends and family how to listen to this and other great progressive programs. Tag, you're it. So, Joe, I can imagine things, but, you know, growing up white in a almost entirely white, well, actually, it was an entirely white neighborhood for at least half of my, you know, childhood, I don't have the experiences that you have had and hope to learn from your stories of that. How challenging was it growing up as a kid in, now you were in an integrated neighborhood?
No, it was nothing. Well, I mean, if you count the one white person that lived across the street who couldn't afford to move when the neighborhood changed. I mean, one white person is integration, but you know, that's what tends to happen on both sides of that equation. You let two or three black people move into an all-white neighborhood, and I'll be damned, it's integrated. What are you talking about? And once again, because remember, people forget, they used to call it blockbusting. I remember a leader, a businessman in my community growing up in Dayton, Ohio. He was the mortician, Clarence Bowman. And remember, in the black neighborhood, the mortician and the doctors and maybe the lawyers, depending on where you live, and the preachers, were some of the most independent people in your neighborhood. But I always remember he moved out of the traditional west side of Dayton, Ohio, and he moved into a all-white neighborhood. And it made big news. I mean, big news. And he actually told a reporter, I don't want the next black family to move on the same block. And a lot of people didn't understand what he was saying. Matter of fact, they got rather angry. What do you mean you don't want them being your neighbor? And what he said, no, don't move on my block. Move on the block down the street. Move on a block in the next subdivision. Because if one black person moved in and two moved in, then what happened would be the real estate agents would get on the phone and call the white neighbors and white homeowners and say, you know, you might want to move. Your home values are going to go down. Well, why is that? Because black people are moving into the neighborhood. That actually happened to me when I first got to Detroit. And I moved into, quote unquote, integrated neighborhoods. And I would actually get phone calls from white real estate agents who would say, would you think about selling your house? Because you know the neighborhood is changing.
Oh, jeez. We'll continue the story in just a second. We'll be right back with Joe Madison, one of the most talented men on talk radio. JoeMadison.com is the website. We'll be right back with more Joe Madison in just a moment. Stick around. So over at TomHartmann.com, we put up a video that talks about Malcolm X saying, if you're not careful, the newspapers will have you hating the people who are oppressed and loving the people who are the oppressors. He said that 55 years ago, in 1965. And, you know, what that actually means, how that warning from Malcolm X was apparently taken to heart by the Republican Party in 1981. Through the Reagan presidency, and we actually saw this shift in America to the point where, you know, that led to everything. You stop and frisk and the demonization of homeless people and the demonization of poor people and black people and Muslim people and all of this stuff came out of this very specific kind of Lee Atwater strategy in the 1980s. So you can find it over at TomHartmann.com and check it out. And welcome back. We're talking with Joe Madison, host of The Joe Madison Show, weekdays 6 to 10 a.m. on Sirius XM channel 126. JoeMadison.com is his website. Madison Sirius XM is Twitter handle. Joe, you and I were talking about blockbusting, integrating neighborhoods, and how that was going on. The closest I ever got to that was when Louise and I were moving to Atlanta back in 1983, I think it was. And Louise flew down, I flew down, looked at houses, and then Louise flew down and we had different real estate agents. And the real estate agent who picked Louise up said to Louise, would you like to see all white neighborhoods or integrated neighborhoods? And Louise said, I believe it's a crime for you to ask me that question. And said, you know, stop the car, I'm getting out. Or maybe, you know, take me back to the real estate agent. I don't recall because I wasn't there. But that, you know, Louise was so pissed off at this woman that she fired the real estate agency. She later called the woman's boss. But that, I mean, you know, that's as close as we got to it. But you were talking about what it was like then. Frankly, I'm guessing in some parts of the country, it's very much like that right now.
Certainly it is. But let me tell you what you just gave an example of to fast forward to where we are in 2021. What Louise did in 1983 is what we today refer to being anti-racist. Listen to me, being anti-racist. Because what she did, let me out. I'm not going to be a part of this. She could have said to that real estate agent, excuse me, I'm not racist. You know, I'm not racist. But she decided, not only am I not racist, but I am not going to do business with you. I am going to be anti-racist. And that's why I wanted to fast forward to how you brought the past, and I wanted to bring it up to today. People have to understand, sometimes you cannot be racist and still benefit from racism. Think about that.
I'm sure that's the story of every white person's life in America, Joe, isn't it?
That's in many cases, unless they practice anti-racism. And there's a difference between saying I'm not racist and being anti-racist, because I don't know how many people would do what Louise did, to be honest. They might dismiss it. Who knows? But that's what that said to me. But I can guarantee you, in your lifetime, you never had anyone call up and tell you some white people are in your neighborhood, so you might want to move.
Right. Which happened to you. Only it wasn't white people. They called you and said they thought you were white. Yeah.
Oh, and I pretended to be white. You know, I said, really? Oh, well, tell me, how many, and what, you know, and got it, which, by the way, was illegal. And again, prior to the Housing Act, people could do that. And thank God for, you know, black people and white people coming together. You know, one of the ways that we were able, Tom, to break up housing discrimination covenants was that white testers had to go to a neighborhood to rent or buy a home, and then they came back and worked with organizations to end blockbusting. And so that's what we're looking for, I think, in America today. In anticipation, Tom, of this conversation that we were going to have, I'm prepared to say something that most people wouldn't say on Martin Luther King Day. And that is, we will never get rid of racism in America. Never. And I don't come to that conclusion lightly. Racism is like a virus. And you're one of the smartest people I know as a communicator, and I just finished reading your book on healthcare. But racism is a virus, and you do not kill a virus. Viruses are not killed. And let me tell you what they will often do. They will mutate. And that's what we saw last week on Capitol Hill, a bunch of mutants.
There you go. Yeah, and let's extend that and get into Martin Luther King also right after the break. We'll be right back in about 6 minutes.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
Our book today is The Poisoned City, Flint's Water and the American Urban Tragedy by Anna Clark. This is from the prologue. On a hot day in the summer of 2014, in the Civic Park neighborhood where Pastor R. Sherman McCathern preached in Flint, Michigan, water rushed out of a couple of fire hydrants. Puddles formed on the dry grass and splashed the skin of the delighted kids who ran through it. But the spray looked strange. The water was coming out dark as coffee for hours, McCathern remembered. The shock of it caught in his throat. Something is wrong here. Something had been wrong for months. That spring, Flint, under the direction of state officials, turned off the drinking water that it had relied on for nearly 50 years. The city planned to join a new regional system called the Carignody Water Authority. And while it waited for the KWA to be built, it began bringing in its water from the Flint River. McCathern didn't pay much attention to the politicking around all this. He had enough to worry about with his busy parish. But after the switch, many of his neighbors grew alarmed at the water that flowed from their kitchen faucets and showerheads. They packed public meetings, wrote questioning letters, and protested at City Hall. They filled clear plastic bottles in their taps to show how the water looked brown or orange and sometimes had particulates floating in it. Showering seemed to be connected with skin rashes and hair loss. The water smelled foul. A sip of it put the taste of a cold metal coin on your tongue. But the authorities said everything was all right and you could drink it, so people did, McCathern said later. Residents were advised to run their faucets for a few minutes before using the water to get a clean flow. But as the months went by, the city plant tinkered with treatment and issued a few boil water advisories. State environmental officials said again and again that there was nothing to worry about. The water was just fine. Whatever their senses told them, whatever the whispers around town, whatever Flint's troubled history with powerful institutions telling them what was best for them, this wasn't actually hard for people like McCathern to believe. Public water systems are one of this country's most heroic accomplishments, a feat so successful that it's almost invisible. By making it a commonplace for clean water to be delivered to homes, businesses, and schools, we have saved untold lives from what today sound like antiquated diseases in a Charles Dickens novel, cholera, dysentery, typhoid fever. Here in Flint, it was instrumental in turning General Motors, founded in 1908 in Vehicle City, as the town was known, into a global economic giant. The advancing underground network of pipes defined the growing city and its metropolitan region, which boasted of being home to one of the strongest middle classes in the entire United States. McCathern is a tall, bald man with a thin mustache and a scratchy rasp in his baritone voice. At the time of the water switch, he had led the non-denominational Joy Tabernacle Church for about 15 years. It was founded in the YMCA in downtown Flint, where it held baptisms in the swimming pool. But in 2009, it made a home in Civic Park, where a Presbyterian church closed after 85 years and gave its sanctuary over to the young and hopeful congregation. By then, Civic Park, one of America's oldest subdivisions, was a desert of deserted, historically significant homes, the pastor said. Built between 1917 and 1919 by General Motors and DuPont and Company, along curving, tree-lined boulevards, the tidy houses were designed for Flint's auto workers and their families. But over the years, the neighborhood was blighted by vacancy. Empty two stories with lurching front porches and crumbling roofs sat alongside crisply painted homes where Flint residents, they sometimes call themselves Flintoids or Flintstones, still lived their lives. When the sound of gunshots on the street outside interrupted services, McCathern gave a nod to the church musicians, urging them to play louder. Some called Joy Tabernacle a thug church, he said, but McCathern saw the good. The young men filling his pews built a proud society, if not by getting their names on the honor roll, then by tagging their names with spray paint. In the end, people just want to be seen. The ghosts of the past went well beyond Civic Park. Between General Motors and the United Auto Workers, the city had been a flourishing hub for American innovation. There were more than 100 different manufacturing establishments in town. 10 of them employed at least 1,000 people each. And they not only made automobiles, but paints, varnishes, tools, dyes, cotton, textiles, and a wealth of other products. Flint had one of the highest per capita incomes in the entire nation. And despite being severely segregated, it was a magnet for African-American migrants from the South. When Vice President Hubert Humphrey stopped by during the campaign for the 1964 presidential election, he praised Flint for, quote, zooming ahead with unbelievable growth and progress. Workers earned wages that are very good, Humphrey said, and, quote, because of the great labor management program in the community over many years, there has been a constant rise in the standard of living, end quote. Away from the assembly lines and the executive suites, the people of Flint felt that the city just shouldn't be a place to work. It should also be a place to thrive. Charles Stewart Mott, an auto pioneer who became GM's single largest stockholder and three-term mayor, created a nationally renowned community schools program that provided education, skills-building workshops, and social services. The book, The Poison City. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Joe Madison, the Black Eagle, over on SiriusXM 126, 6 a.m. to 10 a.m., Monday through Friday, Eastern Time, of course. JoeMadison.com, the website, Madison SiriusXM, the Twitter handle. As we hit the break there, you were talking about how we're never going to get rid of racism in America and how it's like a virus. You know, we have succeeded in containing some viruses. How do we best contain or eliminate the impacts of racism so that, basically racists are left to mumbling to themselves, but there's not much they can do in the public square?
Let's go back. I think we first have to agree. Can we equate it to a virus? And, you know, I think it's a misnomer when we say, we're going to kill this this virus, this COVID-19. No. That virus will always be with us. Now, what you have to do is that you have to, and you ask the question, you have to contain it so that it doesn't become mainstream. And you have to be able to look at all your institutions. Let's take the institution we're part of, and that is media, the media platform. The media has been and is still engaged in engineering hate. Look at what has just happened with the discussion about Facebook. All of a sudden, Facebook has gotten religion, and what they allowed Fox was allowed to perpetrate. You have to constantly prevent it from becoming mainstream, because what happens is that racism will attach itself to any institution, any entity that it can. It penetrates into the very psyche of people, and then it replicates itself. So, you know, instead of a mob wearing white hoods and robes, you got some guy with a helmet with horns wearing fur and mega caps. And that's how you fight it. You have to do what scientists do with a virus. You always have to look for an antidote. And you have to engage everyone in that fight. We must prevent it from becoming mainstream. But let me tell you, it's always going to be with us. It is in the DNA of the United States of America. And I know that's not the most popular thing to say on a day that we honor a man who talked about love and brotherhood and sisterhood. But I think if you go back and you read his last speech, then to the mountaintop, a lot of people always get stuck on the climax of that speech, but they should go back and reread it and listen to it. He talks about boycotting Coca-Cola, seal test, and most people don't even know what seal test ice cream is. He talked about we may have to use these different mechanisms in order to make sure it doesn't get into the mainstream of America. But, Tom, it is part of our DNA, and I just think we just have to always be on the lookout on how to prevent it from spreading.
Dr. King had specific suggestions, in addition to calling out racism, but, you know, nonviolence, the nonviolence of Jesus, essentially, Gandhi in a more modern era, was kind of his polar star, it seems. There were a number of other people. Malcolm X, for example, had somewhat different solutions. How do you see, what do you think is the best strategy for... not just for the African American community, but for their white allies and of all races across the country in America toward this goal, Joe?
Let's go back to a point you bring up, Malcolm X. That Malcolm X, you got to remember, Malcolm X evolved, and folk always know about there was a younger Malcolm X, and then there was the Shabazz, the Malcolm X who also gave a great speech that talked about the ballot or the bullet. He didn't say the ballot and the bullet. So that was the answer. That's the answer to your question. Look at the power that the ballot had in 2020. Talk about whether Donald Trump is going crazy. And no, it isn't about is he going crazy. He was crazy before he became president. And look at what he did. Look at what happened because of Pennsylvania. Let's just deal with it. Philadelphia, Michigan, Detroit, Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and Georgia, Atlanta. What did they all have in common? The power of the ballot. And by the way, not a shot was fired. Not a person was killed or stampeded. Not a policeman was run over. And so, therefore, when you ask what changes is the power of the ballot, which changes public policy, and which is an antidote to those who, in fact, would perpetrate the mutation of racism. And think about this. Racism has mutated to the founders saying that black people are three-fifths human beings, which really was a power move because the South had more black folk in their states than they had white people. So it was arithmetic. To now, to the Klan with hoods, and they came into existence because black people in the South, because of Reconstruction, was gaining political control, and to now where you have these white supremacists who then take over the Capitol. So the politics now has to be that we hold these people accountable, every last single one of them. And my position is you give them no quarters. You give them no quarter, because we all know that, and you've said it, I've said it, when Black Lives Matter was thinking of last summer about a couple of summers ago, whenever it was, about holding a rally, and a couple of hundred people were going to show up, they turned out that not only the National Guard, but the National Guard was armed. So this is the solution. You're never going to kill. Look, the polio virus, the smallpox virus, the plague, those viruses still exist. All it takes is the right condition, and it will sprout again. It will infect. And we just have to be honest about it, and it infects every institution in our human existence. From religion to politics to education to media, you name it. I don't think, maybe with the exception of Antarctica, that there is a continent where racism doesn't exist. You've lived in Germany. You know what it is like, and you know what the Germans did after World War II to try to eradicate. And look what happened. It did what? It mutated and popped up again.
But it seems to me that Trump has unleashed this virus in a whole brand new way. And I'd like to get your thoughts on how bad, how much impact, you know, how many young people, for example, coming up now, have been infected with the racist, with the virus of racism as a consequence of the Trump presidency and Stephen Miller and all these guys. We'll be back with Joe Madison in just a moment.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're talking with civil and human rights activist Joe Madison, the host of The Joe Madison Show, weekdays 6 to 10 a.m. Eastern on SiriusXM 126. On the Science Revolution this week, will AI robots destroy the human race? And why does AI intelligence bond more with the far right? John Knoll from Greenpeace USA is here on how he thinks big oil and gas funded the attempted coup on January 6th. Latricia Adams of Black Millennials for Flint drops by saying, finally, charges on the Flint water crisis. It's been more than 6 years since the Flint water crisis began when the children of Flint were poisoned by lead and by their governor. Plus, in our geeky science, there's a new study out, and guess what? Eating chili peppers could add years to your life and could cut your risk of cancer and heart disease. Tune into the Science Revolution wherever fine podcasts are available. So, Joe, it seems to me that Trump has set this entire country back something on the order of 50 or 60 years, not just with regards to race, but with regards to a whole bunch of stuff, you know, science denial and know-nothingism and, you know, the introduction of violence and brutality as a tool of politics and just all kinds of stuff. What's your sense of the impact of this, and how is it differently impacting, you know, white folks and people of color across the country?
Okay, and when we come back, I'll just answer it. But I think what it has done, it has forced them, like we did in the 60s, 50 years ago, you got to make a choice as to what side you're on, who you identify with. I think that's one of the benefits. There is no room for neutrality in this situation. No one can be neutral in what happened last week. You can't be neutral. You know, Dante, you know, the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who maintain a position of neutrality during a time of moral crisis. And I think that's what Donald Trump has forced this country to deal with, and particularly the Republican Party. You just can't be neutral, not in the face of what we just saw.
They're sure trying.
It's
somewhere between funny and pathetic, you know?
It's funny because we laugh to keep from crying. But, I mean, I think that's one of the positive aspects. But it's not going to happen overnight, and it's going to take time. To root it took a damn near 50 years, did it not, to root the Dixiecrats out of the Democratic Party?
Yeah, true.
It took 50 years,
and a bunch of them just became Republicans.
and they became Republicans. That's what I said. Yeah. They rooted them out, and then they transplanted themselves thanks to what's his name with the Southern Strategy. Southern Strategy was about transplanting.
And Lee Atwater.
Lee Atwater, that's the person that I'm thinking about, Lee Atwater. You know, Lee Atwater just simply transplanted them over there.
Yeah, and he did a very effective job at it, you know, thank God David Korn found that audio of him, just basically laying it out to people.
Yeah. I play it all the time. But
yeah.
Are we taking a break?
Okay, Joe Madison is with us. We'll be back. Joe's Twitter handle is MadisonSiriusXM. You can find his website at joemadison.com. Quick
Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. It's accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Hartman with two N's. netsuite.com/Hartman. That's netsuite.com/Hartman.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Joe Madison on the line with us, the Black Eagle, with Sirius XM channel 126, 6 to 10 a.m. Eastern, every single weekday for many, many years now. Civil and human rights activist. JoeMadison.com is his website. His Twitter handle, MadisonSiriusXM. Be sure to check him out, follow him, say hi. So, Joe, Donald Trump began his campaign with racism. I mean, his entire life has been about racism. From the time he was a kid working for his dad and writing the letter C for colored on rental applications. But he began his campaign with racism. He's been explicitly racist throughout. He's now, his latest racist, you know, hand grenade has been, arguing that Joe Biden didn't win by 7 million votes. Those were all fraudulent votes in large African-American dominant cities, you know, Detroit and Philadelphia and Milwaukee and whatnot. I mean, it's just a continuous thread throughout there. How much impact do you think this is going to have? How far back has the 4 years of the Trump presidency set America? What kind of impact is this having on young people of all races?
I got to tell you, when you asked that question before the break, I wanted everybody to stop for a moment and look at the mob. You didn't see old white-haired, blue-haired women on crutches and in handicapped scooters trying to break into the Capitol. These were young white people, male and female, climbing the walls, breaking down the doors. Those are young people. My goodness. So I'm kind of laughing to keep from crying because it really answers your question. Those are people who are in their 20s and their 30s. So understand, they're going to live maybe 30, 50 more years. And God forbid that they educate their children. But can you imagine if you saw your father or your mother? But why am I saying this? Wait a minute. The handcuff guy, his mother just got arrested. You know, in Kenosha, the mother drove a 17-year-old with a loaded gun, who ended up shooting people, and they didn't even live in the state of Wisconsin. How long does the impact? Once again, it depends on the education, man, and who does the educating. Dr. Martin Luther King, great quote, and I use it all the time, and it's not the I Have a Dream speech. Dr. King said, and he has a book of sermons, and Dr. King said that the two most dangerous things on the planet are sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity. And that's what that's what keeps perpetuating what we're seeing. That's the mutation. sincere ignorance. People just don't know. They just don't know. And they're not taught the history. They're not. You do a great job at educating your audience about things we didn't, not what the history books taught us, but you know what people had to read beyond textbooks that are often chosen because they miseducate people. But then what Donald Trump played on. And he really said it before he ran, and that is since conscientious stupidity. But and now here, remember, he said, "I love the poorly educated."
Yeah,
he said that. I love the poorly educated. We are the smartest people. That is a combination of what Dr. King warned us of. It is a combination of sincere ignorance. I love those who don't know. And I get to use conscientious stupidity to convince them of my way of thinking. And then, of course, he has disciples like Lou Dobbs, Fox, and these second tier conservative right wing talk personalities who dominate our platform.
Yeah, it is. It seems to me that the Trump has planted some deep roots that should never have been put there.
Then use pesticide to get rid of.
There you go. Time to bring out the weed spray. Joe Madison, if you have not checked out Joe Madison's show on SiriusXM channel 126, 6 to 10 a.m., and you can also, you know, get it on the SiriusXM app and on the internet, you must. JoeMadison.com, Madison SiriusXM. Joe, thanks so much for dropping by. Happy Martin Luther King Day to you and Sherry.
God bless. God bless.
Thank you, sir.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Our book today in the Tom Hartman Book Club is The Black Panthers, Portraits from an Unfinished Revolution, edited by Briah Shea and Yohuro Williams. This is from Chapter 1, In Defense of Self-Defense, Pathways to the Black Panther Party. People joined the Black Panther Party for many different reasons. The moment of politicization was different for everyone, but a few were commonly shared, including the 1963 bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, and the 1965 Watts Urban Rebellion. A more general sense of frustration and alienation compelled others to join the Panthers' ranks. The party exerted enormous pull on the imagination of the members, especially those who had experienced police brutality. In the rebellious spirit of the times, the party's bold stance on self-defense resonated with those seeking fresh alternatives for achieving social justice and black liberation. Party members expressed a deep appreciation for other aspects of the Panthers program, including its community service programs, which grew out of a genuine love for the people. My neighborhood friend, a sister that I've known since I was about 11 years old, said, "Claudia, I want you to go with me. We're going to go and hear these Panthers speak at PS 92. Which was an elementary school in our community. I said, "Okay, I'll go, I'm down." I listened to these brothers speak and I heard the pitch. I saw the determination and I saw the compassion. I thought, wow, this is the feeling that I used to get when I went into clubs and popped my fingers and got on the dance floor. It was the same feeling, except it was bigger for me now. It was bigger than me. It was full of love of the people. No longer did we have to argue and fight about, "What are you looking at me like that for?" Or, "Don't step on my sneaker," or, "This is my block." Now we really had something to fight for. We had a people to fight for. This is bigger than any gang or club. We had a goal. We had something to look forward to, which was the betterment of black people. It was most definitely something that I was searching for, but I didn't yet know that I was searching. I didn't find it. It fell on me. That was the first meeting. That's what actually started the wheels in my mind for me to become political. I was rank and file. I did a lot of things. The easiest way to say it is just to imagine worker bees. You got one queen, everyone else works. Rank and file, those were the worker bees. We did it all. The one thing I enjoyed the most was teaching the political education classes on 7th Avenue in front of the Harlem office. That was the most fruitful. But anything I did, it was for the love of the people. Wherever I was, wherever I was sent, or whatever I had to do, it didn't matter anymore because it was for the love of the people. We were trying to get the word out. If I had to sell 125 papers in a day and I got close to that goal, then I did a good job. I was originally from Queens and came out of the Corona branch of the Black Panther Party. When the Panther 21 were arrested and went to jail, in order to keep those offices open and functioning, Panthers were sent all over the city to Harlem. I was one of the Panthers that ended up in the Harlem branch. That's how I got to be there on Wednesday nights to give the PE classes, the political education classes. I was extremely nervous the first time, but once I found my voice, then it went like clockwork. A lot of the people in the community who were just walking by were like, well, let me stop and see what this little girl is talking about, because I was indeed a little girl at that time. We started off every PE class with a 10-point program, and we ended every PE class with, okay, let me hear from you guys. What do you want to see different in your community? And how are you living? Then we would get the feedback, and then we would know how to concentrate our efforts. Rent strikes were crazy, because if you had to live like that, why should you pay rent? We did clothing drives. We did food drives. We did, of course, the breakfast program. There were a lot of other things that happened, and they might have been more meaningful, but those PE classes stayed with me. We were outside on the street in front of the office. When you were giving a class or you were having a talk inside the office and there were only Panthers around you, the feeling was just different than outside on the street. The Panthers knew what you were doing because they were Panthers and they were doing the same thing. Outside, there were constant questions and answers with the people. You had to give yourself up when you were outside in that crowd. You never knew who was going to say, "We don't care about that. We don't care about you. You need to go away." There were a lot of people that just did not know where we were coming from and were afraid that if they were seen in the office or if they were seen asking questions, that they'd get reprisals, that they'd end up getting hurt. They were afraid. Things went so fast. Time seems to accelerate when you're always looking over your shoulder. At this time, it was all-out war against the Panthers, and brothers are being shot down in the street or set up or going to jail for years. We have brothers in jail since that time, 41 years. We've had brothers that we've lost on the inside that we can't let the world forget. The government said, okay, we're going to lock them up and throw away the key and no one will ever care. But it's not true. We want them out. We want freedom for all political prisoners. We don't want any more of them to die on the inside. That's the biggest injustice. There were times when our cadre consisted of almost nothing but women. And that was when the brothers were locked up or had to go underground. I remember being on a front line against a policeman on horseback and being 6 months pregnant. What we wanted was a simple street light, and we got the community out there and we blocked traffic. I didn't know whether I was going to be trampled, my baby killed, but I knew I had to be there. I was an active member of the party from 1968 to 1971, and in those few years, I aged 10, 15 years. We didn't have much time to be little girls. We went straight to womanhood. Talking about these things is bringing up all of these feelings, though I hadn't thought about or touched on them for a long time. It seems that as you get older and you look back on the things that you've done in your life, you say, oh my God, I could have gotten killed then. When you're young, fear is not really in your vocabulary. And once you look back, you wonder, why wasn't I afraid? We didn't have much time to be afraid. It was all about survival. The Black Panthers. Tom Hartman here with you. Judith is the attorney and executive director of the Advancement Projects National Office, advancementproject.org, and the Twitter handle is ADV_project. And Judith Brown Dianis, welcome to the program. Tell us about the Black women who paved the way from where we are now, and also your thoughts about where we're at now. What lessons do we have to learn from this?
Thanks, Tom, for having me again. So, yes, I think, you know, we're celebrating Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. And at this time, this is an inflection moment for our country to think about the progress that we have made. But also, you know, we are in a moment where there are people who don't want any more progress. In fact, they'd like to take us backwards. So, you know, when I look back, you know, we're getting ready to swear in the first woman as a vice president. And she is a Black woman and a South Asian. And when she stands on the shoulders of many who came before her, you know, Black women have been involved in the suffrage movement. Ida B. Wells and others And then if you think about people like Mary McLeod Bethune, who did registration in Florida, and then the people who, like a Fannie Lou Hamer, who was a woman who was a sharecropper, who was recruited to vote, first of all, and then became an activist and became a very powerful force in Mississippi and national, along with Ella Baker, who was an architect of our civil rights movement. So there are so many women who have really built the way. When you think about also a Shirley Chisholm, first black woman to run for president, Barbara Jordan, who was just a powerhouse of a state legislator and then in Congress. And so this is a great moment for us to have moved to, but we have a lot of difficulties ahead in terms of uniting our country. This is the first time that a president is taking office in the midst of a global pandemic. And so there is a lot of work that needs to be done. But then on the issues of racial justice, we have a lot of work to do in this country. While hate is on the rise, at the same time, the systems of oppression and structural racism have continued to oppress people of color in this country, from the policing issues that we have seen play out to voting rights, right? We still have to fix the Voting Rights Act. And so there's a lot for us to do. But when I think about this moment, I think about the persistence of the people, and I think there is a saying that we are a country that we are not yet, right? Like, America is still building the America that it wants to be, and so let's keep building.
Talk a little bit about the relationship between public policy and individuals' hearts, as it were. How society changes over time, how individuals become less racist as a consequence of policy essentially forcing society to be less racist.
So I would say that both have to happen, right? So we have seen over the past several months, we've taken down a lot of the monuments that lift up white supremacy in this country. And those symbols are important. They are important for those who still believe in the Confederacy and white supremacy, and they are important for those who are fighting it. And so being able to take those down is important because we need to show that this is not what this country is about, right? And so we have to lean into the hearts and minds. We have to lean into making sure that we have curriculum in our schools that tell children the truth about our racist past, right? But give them something else to look forward to and to build. And at the same time, unfortunately, the policies are the ways in which structural racism continues to have a hold on communities of color. And so our policies have got to keep in step. And so opportunities are not granted to people because of those structures. You know, when we think about the pandemic, black people were not more vulnerable because they don't eat well. Black people are more vulnerable because they don't have access to health care in the ways that other people do. They don't have access to healthy foods in the way other people do. And those come from policies. And so our policies have to match our values.
What are the policies that would be at the top of your agenda for the incoming Biden administration moving forward?
So first, there's the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act that I am sure President Biden is behind and is ready to move, and Congress needs to move that, right? And so that will give us back the tools to make sure that people have access to the ballot, because what we do know is that while we saw increased turnout of people of color this year, we are starting to see states already proposing legislation to make it harder to vote. They want to get rid of mail-in ballots. They want to get rid of drop boxes. All of those things that we know, if we make voting easier for people, they will participate. And so I want to make sure that we do that. We also, this Department of Justice has got to be strong on things like redistricting and policing. We have not had a Department of Justice for the last 4 years that really has taken on the issue of racist systemic policing. And I'm not talking about the bad apples. I'm talking about the culture and the policies of policing that allows police officers to get away with killing black people. And so those are two things. But then, I mean, the pandemic. We have children who are going to be returning to school who are suffering probably from depression and PTSD because they've been surrounded by death and illness. And so we need to really make sure that we invest in public education, that we have a Marshall Plan for our schools, where schools can become places of learning and love, because that's where we know we get to start off our children right in terms of their values and their ability to think about this multiracial democracy that we're building. And so I think those are some of the things that I would love to see move. But this administration also has to do a lot of backtracking, because there were a lot of policies and little rules and regulations that most Americans don't know about that the Trump administration got rid of, including things like teachings and trainings internally to the government around things, critical race theory, and things around intersectionality and racism and white supremacy. The Trump administration got rid of that training in all federal government agencies. And so the fact that they couldn't even talk about racism and couldn't train about racism is a problem. And so this administration's got to go in, you know, full throttle on undoing the pain and the hurt that the last 4 years brought us, but also thinking about what is the progressive agenda that we need so that we all can thrive and that we are all free in this country.
Yeah, it seems like we saw on January 6th the consequences of all this writ large. It's just extraordinary. But I just want to thank you, Judith Brown Dianis, for dropping by today and for the great work you're doing with the Advancement Project. Advancementproject.org is the website. ADV_project is the Twitter handle. Judith Brown Dianis, thank you again for dropping by.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.